All right, so welcome back to this afternoon, or welcome to this afternoon. Earlier people said their names and what they were interested in. Maybe you could share your name and...
Yeah, Michael.
Michael. Great, and you're interested in the suttas?
Honestly, I'm interested in Buddhist thought on early childhood trauma.
Uh-huh.
Or even precognitive trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I've been hanging out around Buddhism since for a long time, 37 years, and only recently have I heard a few people speak about early childhood trauma. And basically what I'm hearing is there's trauma, you may need to look at it from yet another perspective, rather than just the Buddhist perspective.
I see. Okay. Well, this is a good center to hang out at, to touch into some of that.
Yes, it is.
So welcome to today. We've been, just as a recap, we've been looking at the transformation that comes about through Buddhist practice. The Buddha wasn't teaching only a philosophy or a self-improvement course. He really wanted us to be different. And we saw in the first part, we met a murderer who became enlightened. And now, the technique in the Angulimala Sutta was that of story or drama. And that we learned that did have value for us. Everyone felt that somehow touched them in some way. Another angle is that some stories can seem too fantastical. You know, this one did have supernormal elements. Or it could be inspiring but not offer anything practical. I mean, you could read the Angulimala Sutta and say, okay, but what does that mean for when I'm sitting on the cushion? What am I supposed to actually do? So naturally there are other teachings that have sort of different approaches to these things that might, you know, that might include some of these questions. So another technique used to guide people in Buddhist teachings is to offer very practical and prescriptive instructions. And interestingly, what I found about them is that they're prescriptive when you look at them from one side, and they do tell you, do this, do this, do this. And then if you look at them from kind of a different angle, they're more descriptive. And they say, you know, when you are following the teachings and have been doing so for a while, maybe decades, if you look back, you will see that this is the way the steps unfolded. And so they're descriptive also. They go in both directions of time, if you will. So we're going to look at... Sutta this afternoon. I'm going to hand it out now. Okay, great. So we're on the first page is the one that's 1112, and in the middle of it, there's in italics it says wisdom, and so that is indicating this one that we're looking at. It's, you can see from the top, it's in the Book of the Eights. I talked about the Anguttara Nikaya before, so that means it's a little clue that there's going to be eight of something shared with us in this sutta, and it happens to be the second sutta in this whole book. That's why it's 8.2. So you can see already this book, just from a scholarly perspective, this book looks different than what we had with the Angulimala Sutta, which had a title, and you know, it said the Angulimala Sutta, and it said, thus have I heard, and there was a bunch, it was like a whole broken off, and this is just kind of like continuous suttas, number one, number two, number three. It's a different kind of setup in the book. Okay, so as we did this morning, we'll begin reading it out loud. So maybe Trevor, you could start at the beginning.
Bhikkhus, there are these eight causes and conditions that lead to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it has not been obtained, and to its increase, maturation, and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained. What aid? Here, a bhikkhu lives in dependence on the teacher or on a certain fellow monk in the position of a teacher, toward whom he has set up a keen sense of moral shame and moral dread, affection and reverence. This is the first cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it has not been obtained, into its increased maturation and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained.
Okay, let's actually pause there for a moment. I want to start with this first paragraph. So we notice right away that it just says bhikkhus, so he's addressing monks. There are these eight causes and conditions. It doesn't say in the town of Savatthi under the reign of King Pasenadi there was this situation. There's none of that here. This is a different style of sutta. It's very just direct. It's going to tell us, you know, what these. It's just a quote, which means the Buddha is speaking. So it's just saying what he did. And then we just got to the first out of eight. So a bhikkhu lives independent on the teacher or on a certain fellow monk in the position of teacher. And then there's some prescriptive part. It says, toward whom he has set up a keen sense of moral shame and moral dread. Those are kind of unfortunate translations. yeah. The words are hiri and otapa in Pali. And what they mean is, hiri means that sense that of a kind of irk feeling when you know that you've done something that wasn't quite wholesome. You know, it's like you stretched the truth, or you snapped at someone and you realized, that wasn't so good.
Almost like conscience.
Conscience, yeah. Sometimes it's called respect for oneself, actually, in a nicer translation. It's like, I did something that wasn't up to the standards I know I can live by. And then otapa, the counterpart, is the feeling of concern that you might do something like that. Like when you're going into a meeting, you think, oh no, I hope I don't lose it, or whatever. So sort of a sense toward the future, and that's sometimes called respect for others, is our concern. Okay, so just so you don't have an odd sense of what those words mean. And then there's affection and reverence. And so this is now the thing that's going to be repeated. This is the cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it has not been obtained, and to its increased maturation and fulfillment by development after it has been obtained. So that also maybe could take a little unpacking. The wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life, what do you think that means?
I think for me it means a change of mind from seeking outside to seeking inside.
That's a nice interpretation. So that devotion, the inner, the turning inward. Yeah. Any other thoughts?
It feels like a commitment to ethics in a way.
A commitment to ethics. So, well, it says wisdom. Ethics would be more like behavior. The behavior fundamental to the... Yeah, so there's something... Oh, the moral shame and the moral dread and the affection and reverence. Yes, there's a sense of wanting to act on your best behavior for your teacher, for sure. And then obtaining this wisdom is when there's some wisdom around that. Probably, strictly, it means something like wisdom of the Four Noble Truths, so when you really understand the fundamental thing that the Buddha was teaching. And then... you haven't gotten it completely because it says it can then be further developed, but the sense is that there's a point where you get on board, and maybe that's what you're referring to, Margaret, is that you've obtained some wisdom that you know the development of the heart is the way forward, and then from there you have to develop it and fulfill it. So there's very much a sense of doing, of development, of having a path that you're going to have to walk. Okay. let's go on with section two.
As he is living in dependence on the teacher or on a certain fellow monk in the position of a teacher, toward whom he has
set up a keen sense of moral shame and moral dread, affection and reverence, he approaches them from time to time and inquires, "How is this, Bhante? What is the meaning of this?" Those venerable ones then disclose to him what has not been disclosed, clear up what is obscure, and dispel his perplexity about numerous perplexing points. This is the second cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life.
Okay, great. And then those dot, dot, dots means it's going to go on with the same phrase that was used in at the end of the earlier repetitions of that. So this is a very repetitive sutta, by the way. And so, you know, we don't need to go over each step in great detail, although we will read them. So he lives in dependence on the teacher, and then as he's doing that, he asks questions. And so there's a sense, again, of you bring something forward. You have to offer. Bhante, by the way, is just an expression that one can use to address a monastic or a teacher, actually more a teacher. So you can even say that today, like if you go to a Bhayagiri, the monastery near here, and you see a monk and you don't know the monk's name, you can just say Bhante, and that's a respectful way of addressing him. Okay. And so then there, you know, when you ask questions, then you get taught, and this I appreciate that here it says, clear up what is obscure and dispel perplexity about numerous perplexing points. Mm-hmm. It makes it clear that the teachings are not that easy. And so you hear them, okay, I heard that, but it doesn't make sense to me, or I don't understand this part, or I don't know how this links to that. And so there's a sense of asking about that and you know, wanting to know and then getting that cleared up by the teacher.
How does this relate to the Eightfold Path?
Good question. So, I would say this is, we're going to see how the structure of this unfolds over the eight steps. And it is a description of a path, actually. I'm glad you brought that in. It doesn't go, I see, maybe because there's 8 points. It might sound like it's related. Okay, so the eight of these are not going to quite correspond to the eight steps of the Eightfold Path, but they're, maybe at the end we'll talk about how they map together, because there is kind of a connection in a broad brush sense. And this also connects to another teaching about the path that's called the gradual training, where it describes a monk beginning in the spiritual life and going from ordaining all the way to becoming free. And it would work for us too. We don't have to ordain, but we could think about making this transformation to being on the path and then what proceeds after that until we reach freedom. So I'm glad you brought that up. This is describing, actually, these eight causes and conditions are not meant to be kind of all in parallel. They are meant to be a progression. Okay, so moving on to the third. Michael, would you read the third?
Sure. Having heard the Dhamma, he resorts to two kinds of withdrawal. Withdrawal in body and withdrawal in mind. This is the third cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life.
Okay, great. So again, there's kind of a interesting phrase, withdrawal. I mean, we don't necessarily see withdrawal as positive all the time, but it's praised in the teachings as one of these steps. Withdrawal in body and withdrawal in mind. Does anyone have a sense of what that might mean for us as lay people?
Meditation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So meditation, you withdraw for a time from all your worldly busyness. There's certainly that.
I think it's even more radical probably for monastics when you spend quite a bit of time in seclusion.
Yeah. So, of course, he is addressing this to monks, and so he's talking about someone who would do that. So, yes, this is really withdrawing retreat. We can go on retreat as lay people. That's a similar thing.
Yeah, learning to just work with your own internal state, like your own insides by yourself.
Yeah, I see also a simplification of our life, maybe. You know, we don't literally withdraw in body as lay people all the time, maybe when we sit, but we still are in our family or our job. But we can withdraw in the sense that we're not doing so much. And it's important in practice that to somehow simplify one's life and just to give the mind a little space. If you're, you know, working full-time and you have children and you volunteer on the weekends and you are trying to write a book, you know, it's like something's going to have to go to really engage with these teachings in a way that's going to do what? Generate the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life. So this is telling us, if you want that wisdom, what do you have to do? We don't necessarily, you know, yeah. And so this can be... Go ahead.
Also being mindful, we talk about bringing our practice from formal meditation into all activities.
Yeah. So definitely this is meant to include, I think, our whole life, not just life on the cushion.
I kind of went to non-identification.
Mm. In what way?
Well, then, so you, yeah, most of us are fairly body conscious, you know, how we look.
I see, yeah, appearance conscious.
Appearance, yeah. Conscious. Conscious. So now you're perhaps, again, in meditation, letting go of that.
So withdrawal from just the surface level concerns that we usually tie ourselves up in, how I look, how I appear to people, whether they like me, whether I'm doing the right thing to make this work, etc. Yeah, great analogy.
I had the thought to withdraw online, like not sending your mind outside to sense objects as much.
So restraint of the sense doors, in a sense, so not watching a lot of violent movies, because we know the effect that's going to have on our mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so then the fourth one, Bonnie.
He is virtuous. He dwells restrained by the Patimaka, possessed of good conduct and resort, seeing danger in minute faults. Having undertaken the training rules, he trains in them. This is the fourth cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life.
Okay, so this is, you know, remember he's talking to monks. The Patimokkha, just to clear up that word, is the name of the code of conduct that's described in the Vinaya, which was that first basket of teachings I talked about, the Vinaya, the Sutta, and the Abhidhamma. And the Patimokkha is just the name of all those rules. And so he dwells restrained by the Patimokkha. So he dwells within the monastic rules. For lay people, this would be the five precepts. And seeing danger in minute faults, I mean, that's a little bit dramatic. This is very Theravadan, to be so much about restraint and pulling back. I mean, it's a particular approach. but we could say this is like the mindfulness that you mentioned. So, you know, being concerned about, you know, if I see anger in my mind, you don't have to freak out and say, oh my God, I can't have that. But just seeing a little bit of danger. Okay, there's anger in my mind. Oh, I need to watch that. I need to make sure it doesn't come out in some way or cause problems. Okay, so then number five, Susan.
He has learned much, remembers what he has learned, and accumulates what he has learned. Those teaching that are good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning of phrasing, which proclaim the perfectly complete and spiritual life, such teachings as these he has learned much of, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view. This is the fifth cause and condition that leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life.
Okay, great. So this is interesting. It actually includes the learning. You know, the Buddha's usually very much into direct experience. I think we could say that that distinguishes him as a teacher. He doesn't accept only an intellectual understanding. And yet, he emphasizes that it's important to actually learn the teachings. And this is not so obscure. We go to Dharma talks, we read books, we study like we are today. You have to somehow take it in and really make it yours. This isn't just listening. This says he remembers what he's learned, accumulates what he has learned, maybe the only kind of accumulation that's supported here. And, you know, really understanding the teachings, retained in mind, recited verbally, mentally investigated, and penetrated well by view. Whew! So it's really making them our own, making the teachings our own, is how I summarize this particular one. And I, you know, you have to remember that at the time this was, probably at the time this was said, depending how late it was, these weren't written down. So it's not talking about poring over books, but, you know, listening a lot. And people did actually memorize teachings at that time because you didn't have the book to go look at. So if you heard a good Dharma talk, you'd pay really good attention and really try to remember what was said. We have such terrible memories now because we don't have to. You know, we have just save it everywhere. But this was really, I think, supportive of spiritual practice to have to really engage with the whole mind also. All right, so then number six.
He has aroused energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. He is strong, firm in exertion, not casting off the duty of cultivating wholesome qualities. This is the sixth cause and condition which leads to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life.
Okay. So even after all that, there's a lot of work. There's energy and effort. Strong, firm in exertion. I like that it says not casting off the duty of cultivating wholesome qualities. So there's, up to now, there's been a lot about restraint of unwholesome qualities. You know, restraint at the sense doors, making sure that he's restrained by the patimokkha, etc., seeing danger in minute faults. So there's all this stuff about hold back, don't throw yourself out into the world so much. And now it says cultivating wholesome qualities, not casting off the duty. So we're not just to eliminate unwholesome or to restrain unwholesome. We're supposed to actively cultivate things that are good. And that includes ethical behavior, of course, and also meditation and the development of concentration and other such things. So there's a lot actually in the suttas about energy and effort, more than we hear in the teachings in the West, because Westerners are so driven most of the time, and we're really, you know, kind of working too hard in our lives, spinning our wheels. Most teachers emphasize teachings of relaxation, ease, pulling back, letting go. This is what we need, mostly. But when you read the texts, they tend to be like this, is that there's a lot of sense of doing and actively pursuing something, even to a degree more than we tend to teach. This is just my Kim's aside about comparing the texts to how we teach in the West.
It might have been taken more for granted if you grew up in that culture.
Yeah, it might have been more what people of that culture needed to hear, in a sense. Yeah, maybe people were naturally leading more easeful lives, and, you know, and this was sort of a, you know, exhortation to work. Okay, so number seven.
In the midst of the Sangha, he does not engage in rambling and pointless talk. Either he himself speaks on the Dhamma, or he requests someone else to do so, or he adopts a noble silence. This is the seventh causal condition that leads to obtaining wisdom fundamental to the spiritual.
So that's interesting, huh? No rambling and pointless talk.
Right.
So it's like... So there's something about, you know, even in the public interactive realm, getting yourself into a situation where you're talking about the Dharma most of the time, or the Dhamma. And for most of us, this is not an easy condition to bring about, right? If suppose our partner is not a practitioner, suppose we have a job out in the world, we're not talking all the time about the Dhamma exactly. And so, you know, this is, I think, a pretty high standard, is to, whenever you're speaking with people, so that it can somehow be connected to the Dhamma, or at least a good fraction of it is with other people in that situation. So reading between the lines, this is really, you know, saying to find that. Of course, speaking to monks, they were mostly in this midst of the Sangha. So maybe for the monk, for the lay people, it's more a gesture of moving toward a situation where you can interact with a lot of Dharma people, like coming to this group and having friends in the on the path. And for monks, I think it's maybe more the emphasis is on the no rambling and pointless talk, is that, you know, if you're a monk, you're supposed to be serious about this and not hang out in the kitchen with the other monks and say, what'd you think of lunch? You know, you're supposed to fulfill your duty as a monk. All right, then. So number 8.
Can I say she?
Sure, please.
She dwells contemplating arising and vanishing in the 5 aggregates subject to clinging, such as form, such its origin, such its passing away, such its filling, such its perception, such are volitional activities, such is consciousness, such its origin, such its passing away. This is the 8th cause and condition that leads to obtaining wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it has not been attained, and to its increased maturation and fulfillment by development after it has been attained.
Yeah, okay, so on the last repetition, it doesn't, it goes back and includes the whole thing to remind you. And then this particular cause and condition is also another one of these very boilerplate stock phrase kind of things that you'll see in many other suttas. And so contemplating arising and vanishing, we'll just stop at that and say that the Buddha very commonly emphasizes observing impermanence in his teachings. It's really all over the suttas, is this arising and vanishing. This is what leads to wisdom. And in some sense you can say, well, geez, you know, who cares? Everybody knows that things change. That's not a surprise to anybody. And yet there's something about we don't quite see it. We see it all day, every day, and we don't quite see it. Because why? Because we're surprised when things go away. How could that be? How can that be gone? Oh, no. Or how could this have happened? How could this have arisen? This is horrible. We're very prone to these kinds of thinking. The Buddha says, well, you didn't watch. You know, things arise, things vanish, according to causes and conditions. Not, yeah, they have, when the causes are there, they have to be there. When the causes aren't there, they can't be there. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. But we don't see it. And so contemplating means meditating, or I think he's referring there to meditating and really having a direct experience, but it can also mean thinking about, pondering, reflecting on. Okay, so that's just emphasizing the importance of observing impermanence. And then I'll go on, in the 5 aggregates subject to clinging. Okay, that's a common phrase. It's panchupadana khanda. And there's a bunch of different words there. So the word aggregate means, in Pali, the word khanda or skanda in Sanskrit literally means a heap of something. I mean, it was a common word. You would say, you know, there's a khanda of hay after we, you know, got it out of the field. So it's just and it's often a collection of kind of different things that are kind of related. So just this pile of stuff. And so he turns around and uses that word to define a human being as being composed of kind of 5 heaps of stuff. I mean, what is a person? Well, I mean, a person could be a lot of different things, but he says one way of dividing up the pie of what a person is that a person consists of form, and that's everything material. So it's the body, and out in the world it's, you know, physical things. And then I'm going to skip this origin and passing away. We'll get to that in a second. And then the second aggregate is the aggregate of feeling, mm-hmm. which means the interface between the body and the mind, the impression that sensory impact has on the mind. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. That is an aggregate of 3 different feelings, which are constantly changing and are hitting us with each impact, each impact of us experience. And then there's perception, so that's what we make of that. So that we've now moved into the mind. The aggregate of perception is our understanding of what things, literally what they are, in just a labeling sense. You know, when I look at this room, I don't see just a collection of light and color and boundaries and movement. I can parse it into people's zabutons, chairs, the floor, the ceiling, the clock. It's not that these things are fundamentally existent, but I've been taught that this is how I should parse the world. We go to great effort to teach children to do this correctly. And of course, some of it's just natural in the way the brain evolves. Of course, the Buddha wasn't talking about the brain and so forth, but he just noticed that there's an ability of us that we have in the mind to see things. Absolutely crucial. We couldn't live without it. And that forms actually kind of an aggregate of the way we see the world, because our perceptions are, as we've learned in our relationships, perceptions are different, right? You go to a party with someone and you think it's the greatest thing and you don't want to leave, and they think it's awful. It's the most horrible. Who's right? Well, you know, it's a perception in a sense. That might be more of a mental formation, a volitional activity, the next one. But still, we see things differently. Oh, there's another lovely example, actually. I read about, I forget the context, but somehow they had shown some pictures to tribe members from a tribe in Africa. And one of they were sort of stick figures, and one of them was a line drawings, I should say. And one was a woman sitting in front of a window. So it was kind of just her face and shape and then, you know, a square behind her. And everyone from the West who looked at that understood, oh, it's a shape of a woman sitting in a room in front of a window. And the people from the African tribe said it was a woman with a box on her head. Because, you know, there was this sort of square behind her head. Because, you know, they didn't live in places with square windows. They didn't have that perception. They would never have said it's a woman in front of a window. And so that's, you know, a pretty fundamental difference in seeing what these lines parse into in our mind. So it's interesting that he picks these things out. These are what are relevant. Form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, that's another word. What we would never say, we don't usually say words like that. But that's like everything else in the mind. So everything else about the content of the mind. So there's perception, which is one particular aspect of the content of the mind. And then there's all the stories and meanings and intentions and volitions and desires and aversions in the mind. And if you think of this, I think of this one as kind of like rest of world. You know those maps that say Japan, China, Australia, rest of world. So this is form, feeling, perception, consciousness, and volitional activities is rest of world. So it's, it's just all that other stuff that we do with the mind, the interpretations, stories. And then consciousness is also separated out as just the knowing of all those things. So just to unpack that term, five aggregates. So the reason he picked these five things, it happens, is that these are areas where we tend to identify. We tend to create a self around these five khandhas.
Is consciousness different than awareness? I know there's
they're pretty similar.
There's quite a bit of debate.
I don't want to get into all this.
Yeah.
But it's basically similar. Yeah. It's a knowing function.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, and then he says, such is form, such its origin, such its passing away. So this is the arising and vanishing. And you literally observe just that. Such is this. Such is its arising, or in the mind, such is the arising of sound. You're hearing continual arising and vanishing of sound as my voice goes through your mind. Such its passing away, and we just observe that. So we finally get to what is essentially a meditation instruction at the end. And he says, following this, dwelling, contemplating this, leads to, there's an eighth cause and condition leading to this kind of wisdom. So it's interesting, right? We start from very outward things, living in dependence on a teacher, and then hearing the Dharma, changing one's conduct, striving or deciding that the teachings make sense, striving energetically, really focusing the mind. Number seven feels a little out of place to me. I would have put that back in the behavior section. And then finally, getting down to the very fundamentals. This no longer has anything about him or her. Thank you for adding she. There is a lot of that here. Remember I said earlier the Theravadan tradition, very traditional, of course. I don't think any of them included she in their writings, but definitely it's all he. So then we get to, you know, very specific, pretty deep meditation instructions of just sitting and watching experience arise and vanish. And all of these conditions lead toward this transformation of wisdom that the mind is going to go through in moving from where it is now to enlightenment, to freedom. Now it doesn't, it does say, because it's increased maturation and fulfillment by development, so that means the full fulfillment of wisdom is the obtaining of freedom, of liberation. So you had asked about the Eightfold Path. So let's look a little bit. It's not a perfect overlay, but there are, I think, we could say there are some elements that match. So as a review, the Eightfold Path starts with two components related to wisdom, right view and right intention. That's called the wisdom segment of the path. And the next three are the ethical conduct segment, right speech, right action, right livelihood. So wisdom and then ethics. And then the next is called the samadhi section or the meditation section, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So those are kind of the order. And then that leads to, it's a spiral actually, so fulfilling the samadhi leads to wisdom. It goes back to the panya section of the path. This sutta, by the way, is called Wisdom. It's called the Panya Sutta. There were some of the literature for this event called it the Pacha Sutta. That was just a mistake. So Wisdom, Panya. So let's look at these eight steps. So living in dependence on a teacher toward whom he has set up a keen sense of moral shame and moral dread, affection and reverence, and then asking questions. Asking questions, by the way, is one of the commonly described manifestations of wisdom. Inquiry or investigation is part of wisdom. So I think we see some wisdom at the beginning of the path. Deciding that you're going to live with a teacher, actually that's more a matter of faith. Especially saying he set up affection and reverence. So he decides he has faith in a teacher. This is a case where there's another teaching actually called called the gradual training. And one version of it begins with faith in the teacher and then visiting the teacher and hearing the teachings and reflecting on the teachings and then practicing. That's basically how it goes. So I'd say this is very similar to that. It starts with faith in the teacher, which is interesting to see. The Theravadin tradition does have a lot of faith in the teacher in it. When you read the suttas, it's very much about you see someone, you're inspired by someone, you hear someone, you develop faith in that person. We don't have a kind of a guru tradition. It's not as strong as in the Zen or the Tibetan traditions where one really devotes oneself to a guru, and that devotion itself is used as part of the path. It's not quite the same in this, but there is living in dependence on the teacher. That means ordaining. You go and you give yourself over to the life that the teacher is leading out in the
there
woods.
There is kind of an inferred.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the teacher is the
Teacher's the Buddha, or a certain fellow monk in the position of a teacher if you're traveling with another band. Yeah.
But
it's stronger than you hear in the insight tradition, right? So it really is there. It is there.
You can also have the faith in the Dhamma as well, if you don't have a teacher.
Yeah, so you hear the teachings and you want to practice them. There are other suttas where people have, quote-unquote, converted to the teachings of the Buddha because they've heard somebody else speak them, but they're not traveling with that person. They're actually just practicing on their own. There's citations of that. So in the same way, one could just have faith in the teachings without a teacher and go forward in that way. So it's not a perfect map, but there is something about, and the point of having right view and right intention at the beginning of the path, even before you've practiced, you have to have right view. It's like, does that make sense? Well, it does, in that you have to at some point decide that these teachings are for you and you're actually going to do it, and then you have the intention of wanting to practice. So the wisdom, there's some level of wisdom. This is not the wisdom of our hunchship, but You have to start with something in order to even get on the path. So that's why wisdom comes first. And in a sense, that's what this is describing. Somebody somehow gets themselves into the position of hearing the teachings because they're inspired. And then there's this withdrawal. That's maybe also part of wisdom, part of giving oneself over to the teachings, which is actually part of faith. It's interesting that faith and wisdom end up kind of overlapping in these. And then there's he's virtuous. So there we go. There's the ethical conduct part. And after you've decided you're going to commit to the teachings, you have to start living them. And for most people, that begins with our outer behavior. You know, we stop snapping at people, or we stop killing, like Angulimala, or we stop, you know, whatever it is that we're doing that is really obviously harmful for us. And we all had something like that when we got on the path, that, you know, even if it was a little more minor thing, we realized, oh, this has to go, you know, if I'm going to walk on this path. Then there's one that isn't in the same place on the Eightfold Path. So he's learned much, remembers much, etc. So there's this reflective understanding of the teachings. And that appears in the gradual training. Right at this point, it says a person joins the teacher, hears the teachings, and then contemplates them. So that's sort of in this other map, the gradual training. On the Eightfold Path, that would be more part of view. So that would actually be way back at the beginning in the wisdom section. But maybe this more detailed version of it is something that would come later. But in the Eightfold Path, we really have just view, conduct, and then meditation. So it's a little, that's one that doesn't quite map. And then we have arousing energy. Well, there we go. The sixth step here is the sixth step on the Eightfold Path, right? Effort. So one, really applies after you've decided the teachings are for you, more than just having faith in the teacher. You hear something, you're inspired. That's not quite the same thing as really knowing deeply that this path works, in a sense. So then we get to the energy. Once you realize this is really for me, then you're motivated to actually sit on the cushion and actually really change your behavior and start to transform yourself. And that takes some effort. It doesn't just happen, at least according to this sutta. It doesn't just happen. And then, again, this part about not speaking in certain ways, I would put that back in the ethics section, so it's a little out of order from, the
right speech.
Right, within right speech, yeah. So it's a little out of order from the traditional Eightfold Path. And then this part about contemplating arising and vanishing, well, that's right concentration, right mindfulness and right concentration. That's the effort one puts in more on the cushion. It's really the deep practice, the deep teaching that's going to lead to insight. We can have insights through reading and through talking with people and through listening to teachers. Absolutely we can. And there are, of course, just to not be making an absolute statement, there are suttas where people just hear the Buddha and get enlightened. But for most of us, and what's indicated on most of these paths that are offered, is that you have to meditate at some point. That is the only thing that can go deep enough into our clinging to really uproot those deeper problems in the heart. We can help the surface level, our behavior, our relationships, but to really get to the what's called the underlying tendencies or the intentions that aren't quite correct in the mind, that is going to require meditation to root out, and he suggests contemplating arising and vanishing of the physical and mental components of ourselves. So that was a lot of talking. How does that sound in terms of, do you see how this kind of describes a path? Questions about that?
Yeah, I really like that concept of setting up the conditions that you don't really will yourself to freedom or liberation, but you
there's a cause.
Set the conditions and do the work.
Yeah, it's very pragmatic. There's absolutely nothing supernatural in here, is there? It just, it just says set this up. These are all very doable things. Live with a teacher, hear the teachings, clean up your behavior, meditate.
And kind of hopeful too.
And it's also hopeful in its simplicity. It's like, oh, maybe I could even do that. Yeah. You know, it sounds pretty practical. Yeah. So this is it's a whole different style, and yet it also touches something in our heart. It gets to us in some way if we're open to it. Very interesting to me. So let's see. Let's just go on. We're not going to read the entire rest of the sutta because it actually repeats the eight again, but it repeats them in a slightly different way. So where do we get to? It must be on Michael. Could you read the one on page 1114, parentheses 1, near the top?
His fellow monks esteem him thus. This venerable one lives in dependence on the teacher or on a certain fellow monk in the position of a teacher, toward whom he has set up a keen sense of moral shame and moral dread, affection and reverence. This venerable one surely knows and sees. This quality leads to affection, respect, esteem, accord, and unity.
Okay, so that's interesting, right? It's the same quality as the other number one, living in dependence on the teacher, with whom, etc., etc. But in this case, the situation is that his fellow monks are esteeming him. I think it's very interesting that it's like, this isn't your, I don't know why it brings in some ways, you know, how, but others will notice, essentially. Others are going to notice this. And then the last line is a little different, too. Instead of saying, this leads to the wisdom of the spiritual life, it says this quality leads to affection, respect, esteem, accord, and unity. So it brings it out into the realm of our community, our relations. And it says if you follow this number one, other people will notice, feel good about that, esteem you thus, and that leads to affection, respect, esteem, accord, and unity. So the group of people is kind of unified and harmonious. Because a person has fulfilled this condition, it's inspiring to others. I remember one time I was on a retreat with Gil, actually, and he mentioned at the end of the, usually the beginning or the end of the retreat, he said, you know, there are people out in the world who are inspired just to know that people are coming on retreat. And I had never thought of that. You know, I thought I was going on retreat because I wanted to go and I had created it and so forth and I was going to come practice. It was sort of just my little world of I love retreat and this is what I'm going to do. And to have him say there are people who are actually just inspired to know that some people are doing this, I thought, oh, right, I'm not just doing this for myself. There's something about practicing well, even fulfilling each of these eight conditions that has an outward effect also, and it can be inspiring in certain ways. And then it repeats each of the other seven with that same pattern. So they say they esteem him thus, etc. This is what leads to affection, respect, esteem, accord, and unity. That goes on until the end of this page, and then there's a repetition. These are the eight causes and conditions that lead to obtaining the wisdom fundamental to the spiritual life when it has not been obtained, and to its increase, maturation, and fulfillment, development after it has been obtained. So, again, there's not much story here necessarily, but it's a very interesting list because we can look at this and see in our own life, have I fulfilled each of these conditions in some way? You know, they're meant for monks, but they're equivalents for all the lay people, which we kind of talked through in each case. You know, we don't literally live in dependence on a teacher or on a certain fellow monk, but, you know, people do decide that a person is their teacher, even as a lay person, and then they practice with that person, come frequently to their teachings, go on retreats with them. There's, you know, maybe that feeling, or maybe they even volunteer at the center and so, you know, get to talk with them more casually and so forth. So there is a sense that we can decide someone is our teacher. And then, you know, these other things can also be translated into our lay lives. And so I think we're invited to check, are we doing these things? If these are the eight conditions, we better have those conditions in order to get the result. Are there any questions or comments on that up to this point? I think each of these steps is available to us in some way. So I find that a little bit inspiring, is that I don't have to be a nun. I don't have to ordain. I could if I wanted, if I were inspired to. But in case I'm not, there are ways in which all of these could be fulfilled by a layperson. You know, this teaching doesn't say that. It's just addressed to monastics. But when I read it, that comes forth for me. I think there's an equivalent of all of these. And then also, I guess I'd like to say that there is, I mentioned earlier, there's sort of the prescriptive and the descriptive side. One could imagine that if these are the causes and conditions that lead to this wisdom of the spiritual life, whatever that looks like in a person, we could say, well, if a person looks like that and they have this wisdom, we better be able to look back. We might look back and see that all of these things are there. Kind of goes both ways. And so it might be that not so much that we need to go through each of these, 1 through 8, and say, do I have this? Check, check, you know, kind of doing that. But just, you know, do your practice, make the effort, study the teachings, come to ISC. You know, maybe we don't know exactly how all this is playing out, and we don't get, you know, we don't need our rational mind to make little check boxes that we've fulfilled all the conditions. But it may be that 25 or 30 years from now, we'll look back and say, you know what? I didn't know it at the time, but boy, that retreat I went on, it was all about arousing energy. This is this whole number 6. It all happened on that one retreat. I'm just making this up. But we can look back on our practice after we've done it for a while and see things that were coming together. I've seen this in my own path. See things that were coming together that I had no clue at the time, or I was interpreting them differently at the time, if I was even interpreting them. So this could be descriptive as well as prescriptive. So I don't think we need to read suttas like this with the mind of acquisition that says, I gotta get each one of these. You know, that's a certain approach that's, you know, might be not always the best. It's interesting. So now here's a question for those. We won't spend too much time since we have one person new, but did Angulimala follow these 8 steps?
He leaped right over.
He leaped over some of them. Yeah, right? This is all about development. He did number 1, and then, you know, he was living independence. So there are some steps that were skipped in his case. But not all of them, actually. He didn't quite go to the end.
Well, we didn't hear the depth to which he heard the Dhamma.
Yeah, it's not clear that we don't know if he received Dharma talks while he was the Buddha's attendant. And we don't know how long he was attendant, but probably not too long in being his attendant before he attained arahantship. And so, yes, so then did he resort to withdrawal? Well, kind of.
Definitely withdrew from what he was doing.
Yeah. He withdrew from what he was doing, and probably he was meditating. We presume.
Shaved his head, right?
Yeah. Shaved his head. And so then number 4, he dwells restrained by the Patimokkha. Well, yeah, he ordained. He took the robes and he took the vows. And then we don't know as much about this learning part. Maybe not so much.
Yeah, he was in the process, I think. Coming back with his head bloody and being told to just... To bear it.
Yeah, so I guess he was still obtaining teachings at that time, so he hadn't learned everything. And we don't know to what degree he heard a lot from the Buddha and memorized it and thought about it and reflected on it. It doesn't sound like there was quite enough time, because basically, as I recall the flow of the story, he's been murdering all these people, and the king is looking for him, and then he meets the Buddha, gives it all up, and ordains. And pretty soon after that, the king goes to the Buddha and says, you know, we have this murder, it's horrible. It wasn't like there were years and years gap where Angulimala wasn't there. It was all still very fresh. Mm-hmm. So my sense is that he ordained and pretty quickly after that succeeded in his meditation. Mm-hmm. So he sort of skipped over number five. You know, number six, did he exert firmly? I don't think so. I think there was very little effort for Angulimala after he basically said, I cast off evil at this point, throws his weapons down and becomes a monk. There isn't a lot of description after that, so we don't know what happened in his meditation or in his, you know, ethical development. But it sounds like it was pretty easy for him to... He really did just become a different person through his mm-hmm. immediate devotion to the Buddha. And then, you know, he wasn't in a sangha, so we don't know about his rambling and pointless talk, but probably there wasn't much. There's no evidence in the sutta that he was a rambling and pointless talker. And then, you know, he contemplates arising and vanishing. That was that very boilerplate section that said, through his own exertion, he found what people rightly go forth from home life into homelessness. Birth is ended, the holy life has been lived, etc. That's implying this kind of final thing where he gained the insight that led to this wisdom. So, you know, he kind of did this, but I like what you said first, Patrick. He just kind of leaped through it. This wasn't like a decades long process for him in this lifetime, at least.
It's kind of like the low-hanging fruit, and you just never noticed it.
Something like that, yeah. He was ripe.
He was ripe. It didn't look like he was necessarily ripe.
Yes, good wisdom for all of us, too. We should not write off anybody's behavior. Angulimala went from murdering to being an arahant. What about that person who's just annoying at the office? They could discover Zen Center tomorrow, and... You know, something could happen, or they could come to ISC. So, who knows? You know, don't write anybody off. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah. Even okay. Some of our current politicians.
Some of our current politicians. Don't we wish?
That's hard.
That's a hard one to imagine. Just like King Vicente. Yes, but how could that really happen to someone who is so much like that?
Yeah, I could say Angulimala, but somebody...
But, you know, yeah. Certain other people. Yeah, I mean, I think this is a great point. We actually are invited to think of real examples in our own life. You know, could we even imagine certain... politicians
really kind of
making that transformation.
Yeah,
no.
Some of the politicians really say that they're really on their path, you know.
Yes. Distorted view.
Yes, yeah.
In some way.
Way too rich, you know, path in my book.
Yeah, now we have to be in the realm of wise speech here, but...
I'm finding myself struggling with number four.
Okay, what's that one? Virtuous.
As a layperson. Because I don't keep the 227 monk rules.
Right, but there are, for lay people, there are the five precepts.
Yeah, I know, but I'm wondering, like...
Oh, is it enough to just do
right,
five?
Like, I'm not seeing danger in minute faults.
Yeah.
Like, if the standard is these 227 types of behaviors, and I'm only keeping five, it doesn't really feel like I'm paying attention to the minute faults that could be happening.
Well, but they're only... Fault is a term that we assign meaning to. Mm-hmm. So a fault for a monk is only a fault for a monk because he's agreed to 227
right.
rules.
Right.
For you, it's not a fault.
Yeah. It just makes me wonder if I'm laying the proper...
Is that going to be deep enough?
...causes, right? Yeah.
And that's a very interesting question is, you know, what's it going to take for this mind?
Right.
And we don't know the answer to that. And nobody knows the answer for somebody else unless they're the Buddha. Apparently the Buddha knew what everyone's mind would need. But even arahants, so even people who were enlightened after the Buddha, were said not to be perfect in being able to see what another being's mind would need in order to awaken, mm-hmm. which I think is interesting. Only a Buddha has that total power. So mm-hmm. it's interesting. We're walking on this path, but we don't know where the cliff edge is that goes
right.
off, or we don't know where, you know, we get as close as we're going to get to the liberation. And for some, what I've imagined over time regarding ordaining, we do go through phases where we think, I really should ordain. Mm-hmm. Some people do, some people don't. But it's often a feeling, if I'm really going to be serious, I'm going to have to ordain. It's just not good enough. And for some people, that is true. And they, you know, the ordination is like the best thing, and they do it, and they feel like, ah, this is it. For other people, a temporary ordination is nice. You know, they do it for a while. Other people just play with the idea and never do it. I don't think it's necessary for every mind.
Well, then it's different too, because different traditions like Zen have almost dropped the division between lay and monastic in a lot of ways.
They have a lay ordination, which is interesting.
It's more of a, it's like a closer blending, mm-hmm. where you can go, you know, take residence at a Zen center without necessarily becoming a Zen monk.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
A little closer, maybe, than the divide in the Theravada?
The Theravada tradition does have a strong, very strong divide between monastic and lay that hasn't changed that much over time. Mm-hmm. It's one of its more conservative features.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
go ahead.
I don't know if this is what Trevor was getting at, but the virtue, what does it mean for us to be virtuous in these times? You know, do not kill. That's an easy one.
Probably, although that includes the spiders. And,
yeah, you go out there and nap the other day, and it's like, oh, no.
What about when the ants invade your kitchen or the termites invade your house?
Okay, I get it. Yeah. But, I wish there was a little more, like, instruction or relating to our times and our...
This is a good point. Ethics, I have found, goes very, very deep, actually well into the realm of wisdom. Mm-hmm. It's not just the preliminary practice. It's not just the surface level, outward practice in that, you know, just take the precept of not lying, which is, you know, most of us don't spend our day lying and lying and lying and wrapping ourselves in nets of all that. But, you know, do we ever exaggerate? And why did we do that? To make ourselves look a little better, to make something seem better or worse. You know, there's something playing in the mind if we're not able to just say what something accurately is. And then going deeper internally, you know, are we lying to ourselves about how seriously we're practicing or how well we're, you know, following all the precepts? And are we lying about, you know, our actual commitment to the Dharma? And then, you know, a deeper sort of non-personal level, can we be completely honest about what's unfolding in our experience? Can we be so committed to the truth of what's opening in our mind that we stay with it even when it's very challenging, even when it's very painful, even when we're seeing everything in experience arise and fall away instantaneously as if the world is draining away like sand? Can we be honest with that? It takes a very deep honesty to really see how things are. In certain mind states, it's hard to see reality. So not lying can go, in sense, all the way to seeing the complete truth.
Right, yeah.
Which is freedom, because, which is enlightenment.
Yeah, as life were in delusion.
Yes.
There's a lie.
There's a lie in some sense. Ignorance is created by the mind. It's one of the most humbling things on the path is, you know, the ignorance is not like an external barrier that somebody else is blocking us. We've actually created the ignorance out of our desire not to be free. Oh, what was I thinking? But there it is. You know, and it's a process to uproot that from the mind, to get it to stop hurting itself. And we don't even see all of the way that's happening.
It's interesting, just listening to you talk about that, because to use an ethical term, in a way, it seems that there is this surface standard of ethics, but then underneath that, the ethics almost become relative to the individual mind on the path and where you are. So, like, sexual misconduct is going to be different for different people depending upon where they are on the path.
Yes, that can go into dangerous territory, and it's actually a fundamental truth. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, our societal rules are something like moral rules, or even, you know, legal. We don't even have to bring in that component. But ethics is an individual thing for someone's path. And that can
Like, I remember reading a line by Jack Kornfield that struck me when I was considering becoming a monk, and he was like, some people on the path become celibate, some people keep having sex. And that was all he said about it.
Those are the two options.
Just like, yeah, he was like, that's just what you do. You have to figure it out for yourself in a way.
Yeah, and there can be, you know, we still live up in this legally consequential world, and there can be effects of that. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it is still delusion. The teacher is not fully enlightened, and there are real problems.
Yeah.
But that's all part of everyone's path.
But anyway, I hear you, what you're saying. It's almost like, can we get a contemporary version, kind of, right? Like, for our context?
A more diving into, like you were starting to extrapolate what does it mean to not lie? Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's the kind of stuff I really like to go deeper on.
We could, of course.
Totally.
Any of them can be unpacked in that way. When you start out at a surface level and then begin to apply to the components of our own mind.
We talk about the five precepts. It would be great to have a talk on each one of those where you really kind of bring it to the modern day or bring it to the lay person's life. Or the challenges we face with our media, our politics, our lifestyles.
This is where the rubber meets the road for us. This is what we're actually doing in our life. It's great. I'd love to do a series like that.
Do it.
Well,
you could do it while Bob's gone.
I could do it while Bob's gone. There we go. Check out March and April.
You live in Santa Cruz.
What?
You could do it now that you live.
Now that I live here, absolutely. I have given a talk on not taking what is not given, and really unpacking that for our lay life, which is available online.
Is it on Audio Dharma?
It's on Audio Dharma.
Okay, great.
I think it should be. If it's not there, it'll be on. It should be on Audio Dharma. I think I gave that talk there. See, anyway. I had another point that came to mind while we were talking. Yes. So when we were comparing Angulimala to this, this is called the Wisdom Sutta, and it's about the development of wisdom, which is, the Buddha highly esteems wisdom. We're always pointed toward developing wisdom. But there are different means to doing so. Some people develop wisdom because their mind is already kind of attuned to that, and they're very much an inquiry type, an equanimity, see the three characteristics, see the four noble truths kind of mind. And another path to wisdom, though, is the path of faith, and to actually start with faith. So I think one could say, this is my own interpretation, that Angulimala describes more the path of faith. I think he wasn't a studious kind of student, as it portrayed in the text at least, but more he was like just acting on his heart, and his heart got confused and he was murdering, and then he met the Buddha and he totally turned around. It's this kind of the way the heart will just commit to something when it really wants to. And from that, he did end up reaching wisdom and reaching this wisdom fundamental to the holy life, to the spiritual life. But this path, this eight-step thing, is much more systematic and describes a little bit more, I think, how someone with a more organized kind of mind might find relevant. If I can imagine different kinds of minds. Some people would read this and say, oh, this makes sense. It's very clear. It's got the eight steps. I may or may not do them step by step, but it's all there, and I can get it because each one's practical. And they might read Angulimala and say, it's a story. I can't really relate to that. And somebody else could read Angulimala and just feel the whole depth of it and say, this is why I practice. This kind of thing really touches me. And this, cold list, doesn't really do much for me. I'm citing two extremes. And I think when we were talking, we sort of found that we could go to either end, and that both of these kind of worked for different parts of our mind. So more faith and more wisdom. That's kind of the ends of the spectrum there. Okay, so there's a lot of
step out. Just
a lot of sitting. Yeah. Oh, okay. So I want to talk a little bit now about, since we're, I want to begin to wrap up, is that this notion of transformation that we're talking about today, the mind is really transforming. It's starting as something and becoming something else. It's not just an improved version of that first mind. It's something completely different that has a completely different response to the world. And one can, one can ask, well, what is that really? Liberation, you know, is it just the perfection of a mind? And I want to just offer that, we don't have time to do a full analysis, but I want to offer that liberation is said to go beyond even good karma. You know, liberation is not just the development of perfectly wholesome behavior and perfectly wholesome thought, even. It's, there's a number of ways you can see this. One is that bright karma, or wholesome karma, is said to be distinct from a different kind of karma called the karma that leads to the end of karma. So there's four types of karma. There's dark, there's bright, there's both dark and bright, and there's the karma that leads to the end of karma. And those are all distinct. So there's a differentiation between, you know, the world where you're, there is good and bad, and the world that goes beyond, something like that. So this is an interesting point. It's not said directly in these suttas, but there is even in this tradition the notion of something that goes beyond good and evil, something that is transcending that. It's also interesting to note, I just want to offer a couple of images of what happens in the mind as it transforms from one thing to another thing. The kind of fetters, if you will, that are binding up the mind, you know, that are preventing us from being free, are structural in a way that's kind of literal. The mind is bound up with these fetters. There's a sutta where a monk asserts that the fetters in the mind are only present when the mind is being assailed by that particular problem. So if we have the fetter of sensual desire, for example, it's only there, quote unquote, when we're caught up in our sensual desire. And you could, you know, there are even some teachings that kind of imply the mind is only has certain components in it at any given time, and you know, if at this moment there's no sensual desire, then it's completely not there. And the Buddha actually hears this from the monk and rejects it. And he says, no, actually the fetters are there all the time. They may be manifesting, or they may be just as underlying tendencies, inclinations of the mind. You know, and what does that mean, an inclination or a tendency? Or something that's there, I call it structurally. This is my word. One image is something like a medium that contains a lot of folds and wrinkles due to internal forces exerted on it. Like a crumpled up piece of paper, for example, has all this contour to it because it has a certain structure that's holding it that way. The paper, the molecules, the sheets that have come together to form that paper are bent in a certain way, and those bonds stay once you've crumpled them. That's the nature of the structure of paper. And so it's, or a bunched up cloth, for example. And this is a fettered mind. You know, it's got internal forces that bind it in a certain direction. And then you could, so now I'm making the difference between the wholesome karma and the karma that leads to the end of karma. If you clean that cloth or you bleach that paper, it's still all folded or crumpled, but you make it pristinely pure white. That would be having perfectly bright karma. The surface of the paper or the quality of it has been cleaned, but it's still folded. And so the karma that leads to the end of karma, or the transformation, the unbinding, it's interesting that Tanjeff actually uses unbinding for freedom. The unbinding of the mind is to spring those internal forces such that the paper flattens out, such that the cloth opens up, etc. So do you see the difference between cleaning the cloth and unbinding it, in a sense? I think that's what practice does, is that it cuts these internal cords or dissolves these internal bonds that are binding the mind into this awkward shape, and which then distorts our experience because, you know, it's, the mind is not totally open. So the mind, the purpose of practice is to kind of allow the mind to spring open into a smooth medium that doesn't offer impedance, doesn't have folds and wrinkles and crumples in it. Maybe the unfettered mind is sort of becomes a transparent medium that vanishes in a way. So freedom, you know, this thing that, you notice that neither of these suttas really defined what exactly happens. But you see it in people's behavior, or it's described in these phrases, you know, birth is ended, the holy life has been lived, there is no more for this way, state of being, etc. You know, what is that? We would say that freedom is the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. And when, you know, when those three aren't there, what is there? Well, anything that isn't those could be there. And so, you know, that would include compassion, wisdom, love, other qualities that can manifest even from a free mind. It doesn't mean there's nothing there. Sometimes people mistake emptiness or such to be nothingness, which isn't really true.
I read just recently in one of the sutras that said you have three streams of thought that continued on after enlightenment. Thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of non-harming, and thoughts of
renunciation.
Letting go.
Those are the three right intentions, actually. Yeah, so to the degree that his mind was still going forward through volition, he would have only the three right intentions. And so those could lead to all kinds of wonderful, beautiful behavior and qualities of mind and so forth. But as long as there's no greed, no hatred, no delusion, the mind is free. So I think this is interesting in that it leaves open that for different people, freedom looks different because they've just got a different mix of stuff, of the non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. There's still a lot of possibility there, and people could have different combinations of it. Hence we see, you know, I'm not saying that these people are completely enlightened, that I don't know, but we see, you know, very prominent Asian spiritual teachers who are very much metta types. You know, they're just overflowing. Like Dipa Ma was said to be, she was a nun from last century, said to be just so loving. People would just sort of melt when they saw her. That was just her radiance. Others are, you know, much more wisdom types, and they're a little more aloof. And but you know, when you come, you're going to get the truth told to you, and your fetters cut through by what they're saying. Yeah, so, yeah, like I said, I don't know about the exact total enlightenment of these people, but you can see, you know, you can see the tendency of certain minds, of certain wholesome qualities come out as the greed, hatred, and delusion aren't there in different proportions. Mm-hmm. To me, this is very inspiring, is that freedom doesn't have to look a certain way. Mm-hmm. When it's free. How could it be constrained to be a certain way? I think it really makes it wide open what practice is going to do for our mind. And we can't, then the corollary to that is we can't prejudge what's unfolding on the path for us. You know, it's like, wow, I don't know. I mean, even just in how your life has unfolded up to now, did anybody expect it to go exactly like it did? No.
It's really helpful because I know sometimes I'll have a tendency of like, what is an on-off look like? Or you hang out with a certain monk and it's like you want to be able to see or pinpoint like what the freedom might be. Right. But it's nice to hear that. It's,
can I imitate that?
It's free,
and be like,
right?
That?
It's open, yeah. And even my freedom won't look like.
May not look like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to include though, like kindness. Though, when I see people that profess to be wise, but they're not.
But they're not kind. Yeah, because the tendency, you know, the intention toward non-cruelty and toward non-ill will should manifest as kindness, as compassion.
Yeah, aloofness is kind of an aggression.
Yeah.
Well, it would be hard to say you'd be free from hatred if you don't have some measure of kindness.
Some measure of kindness and love. But love doesn't have to look like we expect it to look.
No.
A lot of what we would call love or even kindness is sometimes shading more toward niceness or attachment in some way. But I think there's a certain warmth of heart from anyone who's traveled on the path enough for their heart to open to Nibbana. You gotta pass through some things to get there, and the heart will soften and open in that. You can feel that in someone, even who's someone who's very wise and, you know, more along the wisdom side. So I think, you know, the mind gets transformed into something that we can't really understand from our current perspective. And we may not recognize it. That's another reason we don't recognize it. We heard earlier this morning it could be something that we don't see in ourselves necessarily. You know, if we were really completely enlightened, probably we would eventually know that. But
I hope so.
Because, you know, we couldn't be ignorant about that, right? It's interesting. But I, go ahead.
Oh, there may be ways to measure it now with modern neuroscience.
Oh, maybe. We're going to find the
serious meditators, their amygdalas actually shrink.
That's right.
The amygdala is the reptilian part of our brain, the fight or flight, the one that causes us to explode in anger. Or,
So there are certain indicators, physical indicators.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, we're kind of winding up on the topic, but we have time for some more discussion. You know, what does transformation mean to you on the path? Is that a meaningful term? And are there, you know, examples you've seen, or, you know, just this word transformation, and or what's inspiring about it?
For myself, if you're familiar with Charlotte Joko Beck, she said something about, you know, that everybody's got a different way to like condense Buddhism or practice. But she said something that really resonates for me, that's moving from a life of hurting ourselves and others to a life of not hurting ourselves and others.
It's a nice way to say it.
That's the transformation.
That's a beautiful way to say it. That's another one that can happen at many levels, right? Hurting to not hurting can be literally, you know, stopping unkind speech and so forth, all the way to I'm hurting myself every time I have an unwise intention, even deep in my mind, an intention not to renounce, for example, to hold on to something or to push something away. Even the tiniest flicker of a mind state. So if you took not hurting all the way to the end, it would be liberation. Yeah. And the path of doing so is compassion. You know, not hurting is an intention of compassion.
Change in my behavior, especially, or my self-honesty, and definitely more experiences of self-compassion.
I
see that over the months. Just keep me going.
Yeah, the great thing about this path is that we don't have to wait all the way till the end. You know, this is another implication of the, of a gradual path, is that you know, we get little morsels along the way, and that helps us keep going. We don't have to just, you know, plod along through the desert until, you know, everything happens.
Good
at the beginning, good in the middle.
Good in the middle, good in the beginning, middle and end. Exactly. We even had that in this sutta.
I think just losing fear.
Yeah.
Having not let up and just allowing myself to have a fuller experience of whatever's going on.
Yeah, by being able to open to more of it. Another one that if you take it all the way, it's,
yeah.
You get a bit by bit, but it will go.
It's so radically and wonderfully peaceful. Like just the way that the mind stops worrying and stops fretting and just feels at ease. It's hard to put into words like the experience of our mind internally, but it's just so marvelous to have a refuge inside that you can go to no matter what. And it's like this ease and this lightness, and the mind can just sort of like dance through experience without a lot of concern. And it's wonderful. I just feel so grateful to have it.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, these are great deep understandings of transformation. Even, you know, we may or may not be arahants. I don't know for all of you, but I know for me it's not. And yet, you know, there's so much that we've learned, you know, on this path already, so much that's already transformed for us. We could also, if you have any comments about your relationship to the texts, you know, this was in the end a day on studying the texts. Some of you even said at the beginning that you hadn't really looked at them before. Do you have a sense from what we've done of how they're meaningful to you, or how it's interesting to relate to them? You may not know that till later, but it's just a chance to express a little of that.
Well, I've read them before, not all of them, but what's really nice for me is just the feeling of reaching back into antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
That this isn't something that, you know, somebody came up with at the turn of the century.
Right. Yeah. I've been amazed also by how relevant these are. Sometimes they require.
We know that the Buddha himself was, you know, starting out on a path. So there was, you know, there was something before that.
Yep.
Perhaps that's kind of the nature of man, or of the whole world, however you want to look at it.
Yeah. There's this path, and it's the human mind is the human mind. It's been that way for a while.
And maybe even the world mind.
The world mind.
Yeah.
I like taking these ancient texts and then bringing them into a modern discussion.
Yeah, figuring out what they translate
just
to.
Just by themselves, for me, it's, you know, struggling with the translation, instead of like, what was that on? The shame and
moral shame and moral dread. Oh.
I mean, that could have been better translated than humility. So, but to bring it. So many different perspectives. That's the way, best way for me to come at.
Yeah, it makes sense. They have to be. They have to be made meaningful for us.
Yeah. It's nice to have somebody, a teacher, explain stuff. Some of this stuff would have thrown me.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't have thought.
Particular language or references. Yeah. That's how it's been done all along, is that people have kind of guided each other through these. There's probably no, I mean, if you I think about that sometimes when I read these texts. It's like, how could the Buddha express something that's still going to be relevant 2,600 years ago? Like, what kind of language would he have to use, and what kind of structure to the teachings? He really knew how the mind worked, and so he wrote things like lists, you know. Mm-hmm. People like lists, I guess. You know, the same back then as now or something. And stories, you know, things like that. And so he had these certain, even media, ways of communicating that transcend culture and time in certain ways. Not all of them do, but some of them do. And that's, I think, pretty brilliant, you know, because I'm sure some of what's, you know, written on the blog posts and stuff these days, not going to translate very well even 100 years from now. Yeah. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but 2,600 years, would it even be comprehensible? I don't know.
I wonder how much even further back this wisdom goes. Does it go back another 1,000 years? No, but because a lot of this wisdom, you know, developed in India or nearby places, you know, long before the Buddha.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of this came out of, like, the Dhammapada being something that was known at the time. Not all of it, but it's found that parts of the Dhammapada were from poetry and literature and other traditions at the time. The Buddha kind of borrowed them and changed some of the words and so forth.
Well, if you take some early Buddhist cosmology, plus previous Buddhists.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Moral truths, maybe stay awake in them, even over expanses of time. I really like number personally right now. Number 3 out of the 8 wisdom list. I'm really feeling my practice taking me into that, and I'm also feeling the resistance. Right? Mm. So like, it's almost like you feel the letting go happening sometimes, and then the resistance to the letting go, and it just keeps happening on its own as the practice deepens.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of along for the ride, letting go and letting it flow. And I'm just feeling that kind of call. Pressure is the wrong word, but this sense of it happening. Mm-hmm. It's just my mind is doing it on its own, sometimes even to my own chagrin, kind of. Do I really want to withdraw like that? You know, like there's a resistance we still have, mm-hmm. right, as we work our way down. So I've just been feeling my practice taking me into these periods of withdrawal, both literally and physically, like in body, in some seclusion and deeper meditation, and then in mind, in the way that my mind sends out and wants to experience still.
An interesting process, isn't it?
But it's nice that there are texts to go, oh, that's what's happening.
Like, yeah.
Map, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So this is a little bit descriptive, yeah. Right? You look back and say, oh, this is something that's going on for me right now. You didn't have to check it off and do number 1 and 2 first.
Right.
And so forth. Right. It's very interesting the way that comes about. Okay, so this is much of the material that I wanted us to kind of go through today and explore, looking at these different ways of talking about the transformation that the mind undergoes. What does that mean? How do people get there? Very different paths, very different types of teachings that are kind of pointing in the same direction of something that's indescribable, that's a little bit hard to point to, but something happens and the mind changes. And we've only read 2 suttas out of just thousands and thousands. I guess we'll have to have a lot of these classes. So thank you very much for coming. And maybe we can dedicate the merit of our work today just understanding that what we've done is something very wholesome to not only for our own development and path, but also for the continuation of these teachings. They've been going on like this all this time to get to us, and we can do our part to learn them and continue them. And then also, of course, to the way that our practice will flow out and help other beings, ones that we meet later today, our family, people we're going to meet in the future, and just rippling out, we don't even know how far. So we just hope that we dedicate the merit of what we've done to all those beings, and we wish that all beings find happiness, find freedom, and find peace.